day.
Okay, Hillary.
Yeah, I don't have a PowerPoint for this, but I did send a memo specifically highlighting the 11 resources, one of which is the South Portland Historic District, which contains additional resources under that umbrella. But folks from TriMet and Metro and PBOT are here to give you the full rundown. And I believe we will probably have testifiers as well.
Okay. So yeah, thank you for being here to present to us. If you could go ahead and start with your name and mailing address and then go ahead and launch your presentation. Thank you.
Sure. I'll go ahead and start. I'm Teresa Boyle with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. I wish I could remember my inner office or my street address. It's been a little while, but I am in the Portland building. We were here with you actually almost a month ago to do an overview briefing of the Southwest Corridor project, and I am the city's project manager on the team representing the city to TriMet and Metro for the project. So that was a briefing about the project in total in the Portland area. And today is a little bit different. This is part of the environmental process, part of the NEPA process for the project. And I'm joined by others from Metro and TriMet. They'll introduce themselves, and really that will be, they will be leading this presentation, and I'll be available here if there are questions. So I'm gonna mute my mic and they can get started.
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, it's me. Hi, I'm Chris Ford from Metro. I'm Metro's project manager for the Southwest Corridor Plan. Saw some of you back in June of 2016 when we released the draft EIS. Dave?
I'm Dave Onsworth. I'm the Director of Project Development and Permitting at TriMet, and I'm glad to be back in front of Landmarks Commission. We provided a briefing, I think it was in May, so excited to give you a fuller understanding of the project and what we found. Andrea?
Andrea Blazer, I'm a senior architectural historian and historian with Archaeological Investigations Northwest, which is a cultural resource consulting firm in Portland, and we're working with TriMet and Metro on documenting cultural resources that might be affected by the project.
So we're here to talk to you about Southwest Corridor Light Rail Project. We're going to move on. We're going to do the old-fashioned. Next is the signal universally to go to the next slide. I'm going to say next now.
Next. Hi, so for those of you who are familiar or not familiar with Metro, we are the regional planning agency and we work and help collaborate on major regional transportation projects with TriMet and our other project partners such as the City of Portland, ODOT, and there was a bunch that were listed on the first slide. And so one thing that we've done historically is work with TriMet to work the federal environmental review process. And so this is a little bit of a background of when we've come to you, and then I'll talk a bit about that process. And then then Andrea will speak a little more. So with a major transportation project like this or many other major projects, there can be effects on a lot of different issue areas, traffic, air quality, land use. These are often positive effects, but it's incumbent upon us to also disclose and document and work with other parties on adverse effects. And so as part of that process of how things could affect historic resources, we've come in the past to the Historic Landmarks Commission to give you an update. And so the big document that we get that gets produced by the Federal Transit Administration, they're the federal lead agency on environmental review, is a draft environmental impact statement. DEIS. It sounds like it's draft, maybe not important, but it's a big document that went through and evaluated the possible effects of a lot of different alignment options on the project, because there were many different alignments being chosen throughout Portland as well as in Tigard. This is a project that runs all the way from Portland State out to Bridgeport Village in Tualatin. And so we came to you at that time and presented what all the different possible effects on historic resources would be at the time. Had a really helpful conversation, I thought. We got a letter from you. We'll get to that in a little bit. And then we went back, and after a final route was chosen regionally, then there was a lot of design work done by TriMet. We came back last month to talk a little bit more about what the project was looking like, and coming here today to tell you more about Section 106 or the federal environmental process and where it's all going. This is the federal process. I keep saying that word because this does not replace any local process, including that of the permits that are needed from the city of Portland. So that's really important. This is the start of possibly many years of conversations about this project. Next. So as mentioned, so when a draft environmental impact statement comes out, and these on occasion come out in this region, they have for past MACS projects. Sometimes ODOT does them for major transportation projects, anything that requires that there's a federal action that the federal government is funding. And so there's a public comment period, and we received a letter from your commission at the time. And it was a very nice letter and included a bit of guidance and direction and thoughts. And so one of the issues at the time was the project was considering an alignment through South Portland on Barber Boulevard and another alignment on NATO Parkway. And your letter stated a preference for the Barber alignment. We got a lot of letters along that because one of the issues was it also had fewer adverse effects on historic resources. You flagged concern for the Jewish Shelter Home that is outside the historic district, but it is on the National Register of Historic Places, and asked for input on Section 106 mitigations, and here we are. The May meeting a month ago, we really focused in on Terwilliger Parkway. It is a park, it is a historic resource, and it's a little bit complex, and we had a conversation about that. Next. So one of the purposes, there's, I would say in many ways, three purposes of federal environmental law. And so one of those is to make sure that all the necessary agencies collaborate with each other. Another purpose is to, and really its primary purpose is to disclose adverse effects from a project. It's not to say that you can't have them happen, but it is important so that people know so there's not a surprise later. And then the third thing is to work to avoid, minimize, or otherwise mitigate adverse effects. And so what this compares is where the designs were looking in at the time of the draft EIS 2 years ago and versus today is based on comments and feedback that we've gotten in general from partners and the public and just evolving designs. TriMet has been able to update the designs on the route to reduce the effects on historic resources. And I just want to make it clear, when I talk about historic resources, these are potentially eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. And we'll get to that in a moment. Next. There's two federal, they're not technically both laws, but regulations that we are working with here. And you may have heard of them, but one of the feedback that we got back in May was, can you please explain a little more what these are? Something called Section 106. And there's another one called Section 4F. They're sections of different laws. They both relate to transportation projects in particular. And so Section 106 is, it's a process. It's a process of consultation. And ultimately it is us working on behalf of the Federal Transit Administration to work with the State Historic Preservation Office on a consultation process. Section 4F is more powerful. What it says is if there's an adverse effect on a park, we're not doing waterfall refuges on this, but or historic sites, if there is something that's being adversely affected, then we have to go through a more serious process. And so historic resources kind of go through both of these at the same time. And what 4F really requires you to do is, well, actually I'll talk about 106 because Dave moved on to that. Again, it's a process. It's really making sure that you do a thorough vetting of seeing if there are historic resources somewhere. And we are, this project is going into an area with a lot of different historic resources. I say resources because it is often buildings, but it can be. We have three bridges that we consider historic. And so what the project has done during the draft EIS, and we've done a recent update of this, is identify an area of potential effect. And what this does is captures all the area where construction of the project and the actual project and the operation of it could affect a historic resource. So TriMet has a lot of experience with this, but you need to be thoughtful about things like when you construct something, would you be affecting a resource? Would there be noise effects or other visual contextual effects that could affect a resource? And so we have had a few definitions of an area of potential effect to consider all of that and run those through SHPO and working with FTA. And so once in there, we did a survey of what would be potentially eligible resources. The whether or not something is in the National Register, we treat it the same way. And then we have to assess whether or not there's adverse effects. And there's a lot of documentation that's associated with this. SHPO has a form called a DOE, an FOE form. DOE is documentation eligibility. If you think a resource is eligible or not, why? And then a finding of effect. What exactly would the project do to it? Would there be no adverse effect, no effect at all, or would there be an adverse effect? And when there's an adverse effect, then we work towards having a memorandum of agreement to work this out. Next. There's a lot of small print that I'm not gonna get into here. But we can send this to you. This comes from, I think it's from the Advisory Council on Historic, there's another letter in there, P, Historic Resources maybe. But ultimately what we're aiming for is the federal government FTA will consult with SHPO to say, do you feel like we've adequately documented the effects on this and that we've come to adequate resolution? And this will be documented in a memorandum of agreement between FTA and SHPO. And so there's a degree that there is 106 consultation now. What we're trying to do is gather input on ways to mitigate adverse effects on historic resources. Section 4F, I mentioned before, it has additional requirements on it. And so something like Terwilliger Parkway is complex because it gets 4F from two different ways. It's both a park and a historic resource. We really fold those both in together. Ultimately, what we're looking for is what FTA needs to hear the SHPO say is that they feel like the project has done all reasonable or possible planning to minimize the effect on historic resources. I think at this point, I'm turning this over to Andrea. Dave, did I miss any key? Oh, actually there is a key point on this, which is, you know, we're gonna see a lot of things here about the adverse effects on historic resources. I mentioned the disclosure part of environmental law. And so what we really have to do is disclose the maximum possible adverse effect. So sometimes we may say, hey, a resource we believe could be demolished as a result of a project. That does not mean it will be. It is possible that with more time to evolve designs or other adjustments that something can be avoided. It is not a promise of that, but we have to look at a worst case scenario here. We need to make sure that the public and other and decision makers are aware of what the project could do at its most. So the project is at about 15% designs and move on to 30 and 60% work. And so this is not the last chance saloon. This is part of a conversation.
Chris, will you explain what area of potential effect is and why we chose this and how it was determined?
Well, the area of potential effect can always change in different issue areas within environmental review can have different study areas. So what this one was is it's defined based on the construction footprint of the project plus, I believe, another, maybe it's 50 feet. And that is to make sure that this area of potential effect, and it runs all the way from the start of the project and around PSU all the way down to Tualatin, captures all of the places where there would be a physical change even during construction. The area. And so we want to look at historic resources within this. We don't think that things would be affected outside of it. So when you see this does not mean that this is the footprint of the project. It is the area that where historic resources could be potentially affected, including of say their context. There are two APs you see on here. The one in purple is for the Rossland Bridgehead project. That's not a TriMet project. It would actually be a Portland and ODOT project, but we are working as partners to provide the federal environmental clearance that project may require. So we're also looking at that. As you can see from this map, this APE overlaps quite a bit with the South Portland Historic District.
And for the purposes of historic and archaeological, that's the area in which we use to determine whether or not there is a resource potential resource in there.
I will mention archaeological things, by the way, which is that we have done some shovel testing. We say we really mean our sub-consultants, and I don't believe any archaeological resources have been found of great note. However, there would still be monitoring and other work that happens during construction of the project. This is a developed area. It's difficult to, at this moment, ascertain whether or not there's any significant archaeological resources. You find that out when you build.
Well, we think there are some significant areas potentially, but they're further south, generally in Tigard.
High probability areas.
Yep. Andrea, do you want to talk about the determination of eligibility and the draft finding effect?
Yeah, sure. And I should note that to get to the properties where we actually did determinations of eligibility and findings of effect, we looked at over 600 building structures, sites, objects that are within the APE from Portland to Tigard. And we did kind of what we call a baseline level of reporting, where we gather kind of a general amount of information on every resource out there that's 45 years in age or older. And we do that to give a 5-year buffer so that while the project is developing and plans might be changing, we've identified things that will become 50 years in age while that process is continuing. So that gives us a little bit of extra wiggle room on how long our survey results actually remain valid. So we kind of narrow down based on integrity and what we know about the general context of an area to kind of get down to this core group of properties that we think might be eligible for listing in the National Register based on applying the 4 criteria and also looking at the 7 aspects of integrity. And then Dave, I don't know if you want to throw up the example form really quickly. So this is an example of the form that we did for Capitol Hill Motel. We used the Section 106 documentation form that's available through SHPO to document the determination of eligibility and finding of effect in the same form. So that was able to kind of build in some efficiency for the project and not do 2 separate forms for each property that might be historically significant. Each of these forms includes a description of the building, what its character defining features are, what its boundary is, what its period of significance is, essentially establishing all of the details that we'll want to know when we get to the finding of effect so that we know how this property might be affected by the project. So Dave, if you want to keep scrolling down. So these forms are fairly intensive. There's a lot of information in them. And of course, as the project develops, some of what we have for the project description and the finding of effect event might change over time. That might need to be revisited as project changes occur. But at least this provides us a snapshot in time right now for the FEIS that we can then use for project planning purposes and to figure out mitigation strategies for things that might be adversely affected, including Capitol Hill Motel here. For some of these, it's easier to find historic photographs than others. Like for instance, here we use some aerial photography to show the context of Capitol Hill Motel both before and after the construction of I-5 just south of the building. So others, you know, we have really nice historical photographs like for the synagogue on Barber Boulevard of it actually being constructed, and we'll put those in the form as well so that there's a clear and transparent history and context for that building and that location over time. And then all of these forms, well, a good chunk of them so far have been informally reviewed by the State Historic Preservation Office. And we've been getting feedback from them so that by the time the final forms actually get to them as part of a report, that we're all on the same page and there's no surprises and there's been consultation leading up to the actual mitigation that's proposed and within the MOA.
So this is showing, I think, where the roadway would have to be expanded to kind of accommodate light rail, sidewalks, bicycle lanes that in many cases don't exist on this roadway now to the current roadway standards. And it shows that we're getting into this building. And so therefore this would be an adversely affected building. Correct me if I'm mistaken here.
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you've done one of these. I'm gonna go back to the PowerPoint if I can.
I will point out kind of to what I said earlier. So what we're proposing is that the final environmental impact statement, which is working towards in the related documentation, would for the Capitol Hill Motel then say that this would be a demolition. The reality may end up being that parts of it could be preserved, but we don't know that at this point. And so it's incumbent upon us to document the maximum possible effect.
So clearly we're taking out some portion of the building. So it is clearly one of the adversely affected properties that's listed on the slide here. Let's focus in on the Inner Portland area first. Let's see.
All right, and yeah, so most of the eligible properties that we identified were in this Inner Portland area, which makes sense because it's a dense concentration of historic buildings, and then the South Portland Historic District is right smack dab in the middle. There are, I think, along the light rail portion of the project, there are 30, I believe, contributing buildings of the district within that area alone. So there's a lot of overlap between the two projects, although for the bridgehead, we're still in the process of looking at potential effects for that project. But what is proposed there is fairly minor outside of the actual realignment of the bridgehead. So we're not anticipating any further adverse effects from the bridgehead portion of the project. See, we have some parks identified on this as well that are not going to be adversely affected. They're just called out, like Dunaway Park is going to be no adverse effect. Helper and open space sequence up by the bridgehead portion, that's probably not going to be affected at all by the bridgehead work that's happening. And of course, you have Terwilliger Parkway and Congregation Ahavat Hahim Synagogue and the Jewish Shelter Home, which are going to be likely adverse effects for the project.
So by impacting something, continuing resources in the South Portland Historic District, we may adversely affect some portion of the district itself. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So what's interesting here is you can see the location of like the Jewish Shelter Home, the congregation, and the district itself. We'll be coming back to those as we move down through this.
All right, then the further south you go down, there's less buildings along the corridor because that's where it becomes kind of green and there's a few ravines that cut through east to west. And so we have the Southwest Newbury Street Viaduct and the Southwest Vermont Street Viaduct, which were constructed in the early 1930s when Barber Boulevard was constructed. And Barber Boulevard itself was constructed along the former alignment of a railroad. So those viaducts are in two locations of former trestles for the railroad. And the same with, oh, that's on the next slide. We have another bridge as well that was constructed around that same time, the Oregon Electric Railway Overcrossing, which is at Southwest Multnomah Boulevard, which used to be the alignment of the Oregon Electric Railway. So that's why it has that name. So that's another bridge that was constructed in the early 1930s when Barber Boulevard was completed. And those bridges are just too small to accommodate the light rail infrastructure and vehicles and pedestrians and bicycles all at the same time in a safe way. Then Capitol Hill Motel, you can see that further down the road. And then there's also a couple of buildings further south near the intersection of 53rd and Southwest Barber Boulevard, north of the PCC Sylvania campus, where Park and Ride is going to be constructed, and they will be adversely affected because they're in the way of the Park and Ride location. And I don't think we have a slide showing further south into Tigard because there aren't as many eligible historic properties down in that area. There are a few, like an existing railroad that was constructed circa 1910, and it's not going to be adversely affected. And industrial properties like Fought and Company, which was constructed in the 1960s, and it's associated with an industrial boom in Tigard that happened at that period in time. But we're not anticipating any adverse effects in that part of the project.
Right. Why are we're basically, you can see this is a shot of Southwest Barber Boulevard, which is pretty typical. It was an old state highway that was built before bike lanes were required, that were built before sidewalks were considered. So in many places, we're having to go back through and add a sidewalk, a planter strip, a bicycle lane, car lanes, and light rail. This is what it will look like when we're done. You can see from the right on the section below, a 15-foot sidewalk, protected bike lane, vegetation strip, two lanes of traffic, light rail in the center, and you can see on the opposite side. If you're going to put all of that in there, and we looked at many, many alternatives, you're going to have to squeeze the right-of-way, and that right-of-way is going to get a little bit larger. This is in the inner part of Barber Boulevard, which is north of NATO Parkway. We're not having as many traffic lanes here, but you can still see a bike lane in there and ample sidewalks in here. It gets tighter. We've looked to narrow and squeeze things as we go adjacent to historic buildings. So first and foremost, I will say that we've tried to avoid to the degree possible impacts to historic and parklands, which is required of us as we go through this federal process that Chris described. Here's some examples of some of those resources, Andrea.
Yeah, so for this discussion, we've kind of grouped things thematically, and that also helped to guide the ideas about mitigation as well. because while it's nice to do individual things for each of these, which is proposed, it's also nice to be able to find opportunities to discuss themes that you're finding historically along such a long linear corridor. So it presents some opportunity to learn more about the history in that way. So at upper left is Rasmussen Village. It was an apartment complex constructed in 1941, and some additional buildings were constructed behind it in 1951, a little bit later. The architect was Ernst Kroner, and it's a good example of an Art Deco apartment complex. It also has a garage that's behind it, which is kind of a neat feature for apartment complex from that time period. We're recommending that it's eligible under criterion C for embodying distinctive characteristics of its type and period of construction. And it's going to be adversely affected because there's a really nice stucco wall that's along the west side of the property that incorporates signage for the property that it appears to be original to the period of significance. And the removal of that wall for the project, in addition to a change in circulation where the entry is going to change, we're recommending that that's going to lead to an adverse effect. The buildings will not be taken down. There'll be no effect to the building at all. So it's an adverse effect for the effect of the property. Capitol Hill Motel is at upper right. That's one where we saw the form for it briefly. It was constructed in 1940, and it's a minimal traditional auto court motel, which there used to be a lot of these on Barber Boulevard, and there's still a few around, but most of them have really poor integrity. They've lost many of their aspects of integrity. Capitol Hill Motel also doesn't have the greatest integrity. Most of its original windows have been swapped out. There's some vital siding on there as well. But because it's kind of a disappearing resource, this is actually one of the best examples left on Barber Boulevard, and it still has enough of its aspects of integrity. Like, it still has the original garages that are associated with each individual unit, and it's got its neon signs from the 1950s that we feel like there's enough integrity left there to say that it is indeed eligible for listing in the National Register under Criterion A for its association with patterns of development that have to do with the commercial development of Barber Boulevard, and under Criterion C for embodying distinctive characteristics of its type and period of construction. And that's going to be a full acquisition because, as you saw on that map earlier, part of the building is going to have to be demolished to make way for the project. So even if it ends up that part of it can be saved, if they still have to take out part of the building, we're going to say that that's going to be an adverse effect. The lower two resources at 11125 Southwest Barber Boulevard and 5350 Pasadena Street are at that 53rd Avenue and Barber Boulevard intersection where they're going to be doing a proposed park and ride. And the building at bottom left is a commercial building that was built in 1969, and it really stands out for the area for its design. And we weren't able to find an architect for it, not yet. We'll still keep looking before everything is formalized, but we're recommending that it's eligible under Criterion C for embodying distinctive characteristics of its period of construction. And then the small house was built in 1938. And even though it's a modest home, it's a really good example of a mixture of the Tudor Revival and minimal traditional styles. It embodies characteristics that are very distinctive for its period of construction. So we're recommending that it's eligible under Criterion C. All right, next slide. So for the mitigation for these resources, the project is recommending at this point in time to do state level documentation for each of those buildings, which the state level documentation involves an in-depth physical description of the building, a historical narrative. It requires photo documentation done to the National Register standards of the Oregon SHPO. There's usually a requirement for measured drawings of the floor plans of the buildings. And also, if you come across any great archival information while you're researching, to attach that to the record. That then stays on file with the State Historic Preservation Office, and it usually goes to a second repository like the Architecture Library at the University of Oregon or some kind of local repository where it can be publicly available to people. And then on top of that, for these four buildings, we thought it'd be nice to do something that talks about that provides a narrative of the history of development of Barber Boulevard from its construction during the early 1930s and how it had an impact along this very long stretch of the project. There's a lot of really neat commercial history along this corridor that comes through in other resources that aren't being adversely affected. Like, there's things like the original Pancake House, you know, and like there's other businesses that Portlanders know and love that are along this stretch that would be really great to tie into the histories of these other buildings that are being adversely affected. and how this area of Portland has changed over time. So doing some kind of narrative history, and again, making that publicly available, probably on like TriMet or Metro's website, and having that up for a while so that people can refer to it. All right, next. So these are the three bridges that are gonna have to be removed to make way for the project. They were all constructed during the early 1930s when Barber Boulevard was initially being constructed. They were all federal aid projects. So they got funding through the National Industrial Recovery Act. The funding for that was distributed by the Bureau of Public Roads, which was a predecessor of Federal Highway Administration, and constructed by the predecessor for Oregon Department of Transportation. And for the two viaducts up top, they were constructed just about the same time in the same year, very similar plans. Both of them, well, all three of these actually are Category 2 bridges by ODOT standards, which identifies them as being historic and likely eligible, but either having maybe some integrity issues or being of a more standard plan. So the two viaducts, they do have integrity issues. You probably can't tell that well from the upper right-hand photograph. The railing on the Vermont Street Viaduct has been altered, same with the Newberry Street Viaduct. And the Oregon Electric Railway Bridge, that has better integrity, but it appears to us at AINW to be more of a standard ODOT design. So for all three of these, we're recommending that they are historically significant under Criterion A for their association with the early construction of Barber Boulevard and their association with federal aid projects during, when a time period when New Deal era programs were a big deal because they were putting people to work. The two viaducts as well, on top of having that significant association, we're also recommending that they're eligible under Criterion C. They're early example of composite bridges because they mix timber and concrete elements in order to get the most bang for their buck, essentially. Because if you mix timber and concrete, you get something that's affordable, but with the concrete mixed in, it's also provides a lot more strength than just a regular timber structure. Condi B. McCullough, which most of you probably know because he's the most famous bridge engineer in Oregon, he was a big proponent of this type of multi-component bridge, and these are early examples of that. He didn't design these ones specifically, but he did recommend a timber composite design for these. So I think that's it for those. Thank you. Next. So for the mitigation, we're going to recommend Historic American Engineering Record, or HAIR for short, documentation. And so HAIR documentation is a step above the state level documentation in that you still have to provide physical descriptions and historical narrative, but there is usually, you usually have to do measured drawings, either historic or modern measured drawings with the documentation, in addition to large format photography, film photography, not digital photography, so that the negatives and prints can go to the Library of Congress. So this documentation is reviewed by the Park Service and then it's submitted to the Library of Congress. So that, because of that, it's at that higher level than the SHPO documentation itself. And as well, TriMet is dedicated to doing some kind of interpretive signage to kind of walk through the history of the, especially of the viaducts, because there's really interesting history there with the layers of the railroad trestles being there before Barber Boulevard was constructed. And there's also ways in which you may have seen it on more recent bridges where they can do like the date stamp of the older bridge versus the newer bridge so that you know something there had come before it. And I don't know if you want to expand on that a little bit, Dave, or if I kind of capture that correctly.
No, I think you capture. I think there's a couple opportunities either below or on top of the bridge as people are going through there. What will be interesting is it will be a widely expanded bridge with light rail in the center, two lanes, ample bike lanes and sidewalks, which there isn't there today. And so I think there's an opportunity to see more of that design and think more about how you tie it back into the historical aspect of that, of these two crossings.
Great.
I do need to ask, Arden, how many more resources do you have to walk us through, Andrea? I just want to be cognizant that we have time to have, you know, take some testimony and... Yep.
Mm-hmm. Just three more, it looks like.
Oh, great. Okay. Carry on.
We'll go through quickly, yeah.
Those are the hard ones.
A lot of great information, but, you know, just, okay.
Wow. We can start breezing through them. So Congregation Ahavat Hahim Synagogue, I think most people probably know this one. It's a very distinctive building along Barber Boulevard. constructed in 1966, and the architect was John Storrs, in addition to the firm of Church and Shields. It was the home of Portland's first Sephardic congregation, and it was their second building that housed the congregation, because they tried to move their first building, which when they were being displaced by the South Auditorium Urban Renewal Project. So this ties into deeper South Portland history than just this building in the 1960s. And we're recommending that it's eligible under criterion A and C for associations with patterns of development in the neighborhood and for its architectural significance, and that it meets special criteria for properties of religious significance that they have to meet in order to be eligible for listing on the National Register. And then Dave, did you want to talk a little bit about the design constraints of this location?
Yeah, I do. So I'm pulling up Google Earth, and this is the spot that we're talking about. So the reason we have a Gibbs Street station here is we're putting an inclined elevator up to here. There's 19, 20,000 people want to go up to Markham Hill on a daily basis. The other connection that we're building is making sure people with the Ross Island Bridgehead can safely get across NATO Parkway to the Darlene Hooley Bridge that gets you to South Waterfront. It's a key station location. While I've got Google Earth up, one of the things that we spent a lot of time on the Orange Line doing was trying to understand how we bring light rail, streetcar, three bus lines, and a whole bunch of bicycle and pedestrians through here. And this activity that we spent trying to make sure this works safely was a very key and a paramount element of the Orange Line. In fact, we observed it for a while and it wasn't working right. We had to switch where the blue paint was and where the pedestrians were to avoid people getting hurt. It's really about safety. So let me go back to the PowerPoint here. So I would say that the next thing that we've learned is moving the station further either north or to the south is really precluded because of some of the other historic or landmark resources. Remember, this side of the street is the South Portland Historic District. Up here we have Lair Hill Park, which is the Section 4F. It really wants to be in this location, and this station does a couple different things. It has people walking to the Gibbs Street over to the Darlene Hooley alignment, then up to the inclined elevator. We have buses that are coming in, two bus lines that come in. People offload here, it's running counterflow and comes this way. We have trains coming here, buses coming here. This is a very complicated intersection to get right for pedestrians, for bicyclists, and for our passengers who may run across the street to catch a train, which we have seen before. So we spent a lot of time looking at the safety of this intersection here and coming to the determination that it actually needs to be here. Right now, we've looked at minimizing the travel lanes, the sidewalks, the bike. We've squeezed everything we can here and feel almost uncomfortable about how much that we've squeezed on here. This station is a key station. I've just talked about the key to the South Waterfront and to OHSU. Metro does forecasting for ridership, and so trains that will start in Clackamas Town Center come down through downtown and serve the station, and trains that go all the way down to Tualatin serve it as well. We have two bus lines that will drop people off here. So we expect this to be by far the busiest station along this new alignment, as forecasted for 13,800 trips that either get on or get off here at the station. And over 10,000 of them are going up to Markham Hill. So it's a very, very busy station. And so we've got to take this very seriously. And so what we've done is we focus a lot of time on trying to understand what are the desire lines for pedestrians. How do they get through here? We know that being perpendicular to a crossing and not crossing where buses are coming through or not making it a small space is really important. We imagine there could be up to 90 people waiting per intersection through here or light changing through here. So you need to have the ample room for people to store and be safely done here. So I think some of the things that we've recognized is this is the right place for the connection right across here that connects you to the station this way and to the station to the south. It wants to be here. And one of the things that we recognize, we have to do ADA. So we've got an ADA ramp that comes up here that really squeezes our ability and really impacts where the footprint of this building is. And even still, this doesn't give us enough room to actually work through here. Normally we've got a 15-foot sidewalk We're down to six feet, 7 inches or so through here. So there's not a lot of room, even if you get rid of the planter strips through here. So that's one of the things that you can take a look at the section that we have down here, how we've looked at squeezing the section on both sides of the roadway in order to accomplish getting all of this right of way, all of this physical elements into the same area. What happens if you move the crossing further down? You have those desire lines, and it's something that we thought about, we looked at, but it doesn't necessarily work much better. I think some of the things that we're worried about is angled crossing to a station when either people want to go through here. So we think lining them up and getting a direct access is better. Obviously going across train tracks at an angle is worse for bicyclists and people with wheelchair devices. So we've also just come to the conclusion that this really doesn't leave us enough room for the congregations coming here of people through here, and it really impacts this. Nothing to be said about CEPTED, so crime prevention through environmental design. You want to have clear lines of sight coming through here. So all of this has taken us to the conclusion that I think that we, at this point, believe that at this 15% level of engineering and heading towards 30, that the clear sidewalk and landing zone at the top of the ADA is really important. The safety of queuing around this area is very important. And the most direct route, and pedestrians believe us take the most direct route, is one that is with an alignment that is here that lines things up. So as we've also looked at other regulations that NACTO and other crossing standards, we come to the conclusion that this is probably the best location for that crossing, which leads us to get into the building. So we believe prioritizing people over occupied, non-occupied buildings, right now it's a non-occupied building, is an important element. And so for the purposes of this juncture, we are calling this an adverse impact where we're removing the building. So want to talk about the mitigation. Andrea, do you want to touch base on the mitigation for this?
Yeah, so the proposed mitigation as things stand now would be Historic American Building Survey, which is very similar to HARE, so I won't walk through that again. And then doing some kind of interpretive display to commemorate not only the history of the synagogue, but also South Portland Jewish history, since there's not a lot of landmarks left associated with that history anymore in South Portland. So this could be a real educational opportunity at that site where it's going to be a very high traffic location. And TriMet would work with the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in order to develop whatever is put in there. All right, and then the Jewish Shelter Home is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. I believe it was listed in the early 1980s. It was constructed around 1902 as a private residence, and then it was converted for use to help Jewish children in the South Portland neighborhood who were often orphaned and needed a place to go and receive help and services. Listed under criteria A for its association with significant patterns of history, under criterion B for its association with several people in the Meyer family, and AINW is recommending that it's also likely eligible under criterion C as a for its architectural significance as well. The project might end up touching the isolation hospital that you see on the right there. The isolation hospital was constructed as a separate building around 1920 in order to have a separate location where sick children could be held until they got better. I think it was used commercially at several points in time after, the building was only the Jewish shelter home from 1919 to 1937. So after that, this isolation hospital was used commercially. It was also kind of totally redone in the 1980s, and it was attached to the back of the building on the left, even though they were originally constructed separately. I know that the project is doing everything they can and trying to get a variance so that they don't have to touch that isolation hospital, but it does depend on what's allowable as far as the sidewalk width at that location. If that deviation cannot be obtained, then what remains of the house after the removal of the isolation hospital would be restored back to its original condition according to the secretary standards. All right, and then the South Portland Historic District. I won't go into too much detail because I know we're short on time, but it's 49 acres, 31 blocks, and has 246 resources in it. It's very large. There are going to be six buildings that contribute to the eligibility of the historic district, which is listed, if I didn't mention that before, that will need to be fully removed and acquired for the project. There are going to be several other locations as well where there's going to be minor touches of an individual contributing or non-contributing resource within the district. But because of the overall effect on the historic district, which is the resource or the property that we have to assess the effect on under Section 106, the cumulative effect of the removals of those six contributing buildings and everything else happening, environmental and all the other little takes and temporary construction easements, we're saying that it's going to be an adverse effect to the district. All right, next. So these are the two primary contributing buildings that are going to be removed for the project. Both of them were constructed in the late 1800s. The house on the left was constructed in 1894. The one on the right was constructed in 1880. And then next, Dave. All right, and then these four are secondary contributing. They were all constructed in the early 20th century. And the one on lower right has been extensively modified, but we found that it's easier to continue calling it contributing even though it no longer reflects its historical appearance. So for proposed mitigation strategies for the district, TriMet is going to offer each building to people who would like to relocate it. So they're going to offer the building at no cost for somebody to relocate. And then if somebody doesn't want to take it and relocate it, then of course they would be offered up for salvage. And we found through surveying for the project that the nomination was done in 1998. It's now 2020, a lot of time has passed and a lot of things have changed within the district. So we feel like it'd be of great benefit to not only the public, but the city and lots of other people if updated survey information was provided for the entire district and that the nomination be revised and updated. So working with SHPO to actually do an update to the nomination and get that through to the keeper of the National Register. All right, and then I think that brings us to our last property, which is Terwilliger Parkway. And this is, again, pretty complicated as far as the project goes, as other people have alluded to prior to this. I think we all know that Terwilliger Parkway is an important historic property in Portland. I know there's been efforts ongoing to try to put together a National Register of Historic Places form to try to get this listed. For this project, we're recommending that it's eligible under Criterion A and Criterion C, connected with a lot of different different themes of history in Portland's history, including City Beautiful and Olmsted Brothers and basically the development of the park system in Portland. So as far as the project's effect on this, we're assuming that an adverse effect is going to occur, but we're still in consultation with SHPO to see what that level of effect could be. And still working on the design. I shouldn't say we, it's really the folks at TriMet are trying to still work on the design and minimize the potential effect, because the parkway is a very long property. They'll only be impacting it at one crossing point, essentially, but is what's happening at that one crossing point an adverse effect or not? Still trying to figure that out, but for right now, we're assuming that worst case scenario, it is an adverse effect. And then Dave, yeah, if you want to, do you want to pipe in, Dave, a little bit about the design, or should I talk about?
Yeah, no, we actually gave a briefing on the May 20th, May.
Okay, so they're in the know. Okay, so essentially more interpretation, especially at the point of where the project is going to be, that way can really emphasize the history of that place and take advantage of the new development opportunity in order to really tell people about the history of the parkway, the history of City Beautiful movement in Portland, of the Olmsted Brothers and Emmanuel Michi, and really an opportunity to provide educational opportunity right there at the park. And then again, still working to minimize the impact of the design on the actual historic property.
So I think we've got this last two slides, and we'll be, I think, hopefully out of your hair until questions. So we have a number of groups that we look to engage with. So Restore Oregon, Oregon Historical Society, Doko Momo, the congregation, which we've already had lots of contact with, Friends of Terwilliger and South Portland neighborhood. So looking to get input on the mitigation strategies that we proposed. So where are we with the project? We're essentially somewhere right about a year in the middle of 2020. We have a vote, a regional vote in November, and if that goes well, we'll move forward. If it doesn't, we won't. We'll be starting with our 6% standpoint land use in 2021-22 as we move forward. It's not for a number of years till we really starting construction. So I want to give you a flavor of where we are. We're still putting together the environmental work and document that we've got so far. So that is the presentation that we have today. I want to thank you. It probably took longer than you wanted, but I appreciate the opportunity to give you a briefing on this important information. We're here for questions if you have them.
What was that?
We're here for if you've got questions or however you want to proceed.
Thank you so much. That's a lot of information. And I think, commissioners, it might make sense for us to hold questions until after we hear testimony, just because I think testimony might raise other questions for us of the team. And so I'm going to ask Laura to go ahead and call testifiers for us. And Laura, how many do you have?
Hi, Chair Miner. I'm sort of filling in as the lead clerk today, but
Me for calling you Laura then.
You're fine. We had four people sign up, and it appears only two of them are here. So you want me to promote both of them now?
Okay. And for any testifiers, if you would go ahead and state your name and mailing address, and then go ahead and provide us not more than, I'm going to say 2 minutes, perhaps, as a time limit. Go ahead.
Why don't we start with Renee?
Great.
Hi. I'm sorry, they were fooling with my computer and it blocked out some of the audio, so I didn't hear the instructions for us.
If you could just state your mailing address and then go ahead and try to keep your testimony to about 2 minutes. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Renee Ferreira. My mailing address is 2211 Southwest Park Place, apartment 1001 in Portland. I'm currently president of Congregation of Avahim, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I wanted to just give you a little bit of history about the TriMet acquisition of our property, and because I don't know if you are aware of all of this information already, but back before the light rail project started, or at least that we were aware it had started, the congregation had reached a decision that we needed to move to a different location. Our congregation is Orthodox. Most of the people are unable to ride a car on the Sabbath, and our current location with the Jewish community being in the Hillsdale area really did not facilitate that. Plus, our building was aging. It had some significant maintenance requirements, and it's not handicapped accessible. The restrooms are below ground at the sanctuaries on grade, and the restrooms are below ground. And we had looked into trying to find a way to put an elevator in there, and we're told that the way the building is configured, it was almost impossible to do. So, as our congregants aged, knowing that they had to walk down a curved stairway to get to the restrooms was becoming more difficult for us also. We hired both an architect and a realtor to sell the property. Our architect developed some plans that could be used by our realtor to market the property, and we went through an early assistance process with the City of Portland to make sure that none of the that there were no impediments to development of that property, which would include the removal of that building. We were already in talks with the developer or with a developer. We had one offer and we're considering others when TriMet contacted us and told us that we were unable, that told us about their project. At that point, our offers went away, and we started talking with TriMet, and we asked them to do an early assistance, an early purchase of our property so that we could continue to move forward with our plans to move. We have moved to a building in Hillsdale for our sanctuary. We're actually trying to lease back the building to us until construction so we could continue to use the social hall and commercial kitchen. And we have removed some of our significant artifacts to the new location. We're planning to remove the remainder when we are able to develop the new location with the social hall and kitchen, which we're in the process of working on now. At this point, we have no objections to the removal of that building. The congregation doesn't. We consider our congregation to be a community, and a community is where the people are, not where the buildings are. I know that that the building is quite striking, but it's not our building anymore in reality, and so we have no objections to removal of that building. Our relationship with TriMet has been wonderful. They've been great partners in this whole thing, and I just wanted to share that perspective with you.
Okay, thank you very much, Renee. May I have the next testifier?
Okay, that would be us, Roger North and
Jennifer Kimura.
Mm-hmm. And our best mailing address is PO Box 388, Lake Oswego, 97034.
Thank you.
We're the owners of the Jewish Shelter Home. Although we've been aware of this whole project, we were not aware of the impact to the property itself. So imagine our surprise when we started to look at it just this past weekend and went, oh, wow. We were looking at the draft EIS and noticed that on one of the drawings that our house is not even there on the drawings. Our neighbors have, outlines of their property, but so we were concerned about exactly what is proposed for this. I mean, you were talking about worst case scenario in terms of removing a building or the property. We're hoping that you can keep it intact because it really is a wonderful property and one of the last remaining evidences of the Jewish culture there.
We have not been approached or contacted by anybody during this whole process. So just coming across this over the weekend was the first time we became aware of how far advanced this whole process seems to be. And it's just, seems odd that it could have got so far without any, with any notification, to us. And
particularly since we're one of the three historic places that were identified in the draft EIS, and then in subsequent meeting minutes, we're clearly on the agenda. So it really was to our surprise.
So from a project standpoint, can I say I apologize? We know that we've sent out notices both to residents, tenants, and to owners. And if we missed you, I apologize. Be glad to have one of our community representatives sit down and meet with you and talk with you about where we are, what the process is, where we are in it, and what opportunities are for you. So that's offline from the landmarks, but I'd like to make sure that I've got your phone number. I actually don't give me your phone number over the thing, but
okay.
I've got to figure out how we have communications that's safe and secure. So
maybe email.
We did provide an email and a phone number to Hillary earlier this afternoon, so she has that.
All four. Perfect.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking care of that oversight, obviously.
Okay. And we should add that, you know, the isolation hospital part of the building does include, in that footprint, does include components of the rest of the house itself. So it's not a completely separate and piece of structure that could just be
removed,
vaporized and leave the rest of the house behind.
Yeah.
And just by reference, it's figure 5.71 on the conceptual design report that just shows our property completely absent. So, that's, our first concern was, the footprint doesn't even show up. Yeah, the whole thing is just going.
Well, trust me, we've been thinking about your house for a long time and trying to be...
Well, and one thing that would be really useful is that your blow up there of the Hamilton Station, the dotted line on this drawing ends just before the property, although it looks like there's components of that, of the Hamilton Station that, would go beyond where the drawing shows. It would be really useful if that could be expanded to, to get at least past where our property and the other properties in the block to the north go to.
Okay, I'm afraid I have to jump in, and I'm glad that you can all connect here offline, and you absolutely should do that. But just to keep things going here, are there any other folks who do wish to testify today?
Can I just ask Dave one other question? Which will be to put on your timeline where the whole acquisition process stands within that timeline.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for testifying. Anybody else? Okay, at this point then I would like to open it up for commissioners to ask questions of the project team.
This is Commissioner Spears. I'll take a stab at this first. Question is, what happens, I saw some of the mitigation things that happened with some of the buildings. For those that are owned, what happens to them from a financial standpoint for those adversely affected buildings? So the motel, if we take that out, how is that, what happens to that owner financially to recoup those losses? Or what happens there? That's the part I don't know on that part.
Thank you, Commissioner Spears. We use, as a federal project, we're required to use the Uniform Relocation Act, which is really predicated on you owning a castle and you protecting your castle. And so first things we do is we would meet with a property owner. We would talk about where the project is. We would assign someone as the representative to that person. We would seek an appraisal. They could potentially seek an appraisal. We look to get to an agreement on price of the value of the property. There are some relocation. There are things that are eligible for relocation of moving people and moving their equipment. So it's all very, it's described in the Uniform Relocation Act that we follow to a T. We do use eminent domain. So if we have to, we go to court, but that's our last resort that we want to do that. We look to negotiate an agreeable settlement with the property owner. And we've done that for a number of different places on every project that we've dealt with, but we recognize we're an agent of change and we're looking to disrupt people's lives. We try and address it that way.
Thank
so there's
you,
the financial mitigation. The mitigation for the historic impacts is really an agreement that we need between the Federal Transit Administration and the State Historic Preservation Office. And what we'll be seeking is, do we have it right? Do we have the right mitigation strategies for highlighting the historic impacts that we have on properties or resources?
Perfect. Thank you. I have a second question. This is my last one. With the viaducts that are there and the bridge, the Oregon Bridge.
I believe so, yeah. I think he's just out today.
Has there been any conversation about looking to repurpose those bridges? You know, I think of stuff like the High Line. I think of, you know, in Sweden where they are repurposing bridges into now parks that are accessible for the public, a way to connect bike lines through where the train goes one way, the bikes go the other. So is there any conversation around that on how to preserve those? I know there were some integrity issues with some of those bridges, but can you help me with that?
And Commissioner Spears, when we first started this, we TriMet looked to avoid the bridge altogether and put a bike and pedestrian on our new bridge and leave that alone. When we talked with the state, when we talked to the city of Portland, we talked to others, they were like, look, these are engineeringly obsolete. They are physically obsolete because they don't have bicycle, pedestrian, and ample auto and transit in here. Why don't you go fix it once and for all? So the transit agency is fixing a whole bunch of other stuff. That being said, it's going to be difficult because it's an environmental zone area. So we're trying to minimize the impact on the environmental zone by rebuilding a bridge. So the difficulty, there's not an opportunity to do the High Line or in the Underline that other people have said for repurposed bridges, because it's the space that we're trying to occupy the same space and minimize our impact on other natural resources.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
This is Commissioner Foote. I had a quick question. I just wanted to confirm that the mitigation strategies, were those recommended by SHPO? Were they recommended by you? Was it how did you come to that agreement? Just out of curiosity.
Dave, you're on mute. I'll start while Dave finds the mute button. So far, they're an internal discussion at this point. Ultimately, those don't yet have all the input from FTA and SHPO. So those are draft proposed mitigations. Ultimately, FTA and SHPO to agree. So the 106 consultation process will gather input from parties like yourself, and those will be provided to SHPO, who will then consult with FTA, and it's upon the two of them to come to agreement. They tend to like to agree. I can't speak to what the Oregon SHPO will do with the input.
I think it's also built on back past practices of what we've done and other projects have done. So there's no original thought. I think for the most part, there's a lot of going back and saying, okay, how was it handled here? How was it handled here? This is in keeping with the size of the impact. Let's propose that as a way of, as mitigation strategies.
So that was the other question for me was, is that something you'd want input from us?
Yes.
Sort of feedback on those mitigation strategies. Yes. Okay.
Yep.
Yes. Thank you.
That would be important. That would be important input that we'd be looking for.
That's all I had for now, Kristen. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions at this point from commissioners? And then I think I'm going to close. Great. I see you, Commissioner Mahoney. I think after we finish a round of questions, then I'd like to keep our discussion pretty pointed, you know, as to the mitigation. We are running, unfortunately, a little past time already. So just consider that. And Commissioner Mahoney, go ahead with your question. Thanks.
I think this is for Andrea. It's just a detailed question about the Section 106 and the time period that you're looking at. You mentioned 45 years to give that 5-year kind of cushion. But is that prescribed by Section 106, or is that something that was decided by this project team?
Yeah, it's not prescribed. Usually you're just looking for things that are listed in or have the potential to be listed in the National Register, and those things are typically 50 years in age or older. However, we do kind of see it best practice in Oregon to do 45 years in age or older, just so you're kind of canvassing and casting a little bit wider of a net to make sure that if there are things from recent past that are going to meet that 50-year threshold, you know, within the next few years, that you're not overlooking them now. And that they might become a problem, you know, if the project begins construction in, you know, 2023, if there's something that is 50 years old and then is, you know, technically eligible for listing at that time, you know, we wouldn't want to let that one thing fall through the cracks. And usually if we look at things that are fit 45 years and older, we can catch things that we would think when they hit 50 years old that they would be historically significant. although the 50, I'll actually cut myself because I know we're short on time. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, I guess I just one question that came up for me, and there may be no answer to this, but it's just what if there's a resource out there that's 40, you know, and then maybe it's an important cultural resource, and then there were, you know, it's lost.
And I know when we're out surveying, we always keep an eye out for things that catch your eye, because we usually have information that will point us towards things that, based on tax assessor records, are 50 years or 45 years in age or older. However, there's lots of things that aren't captured in those records. So when we go through and do our survey, we have to keep our eyes open for small scale features, like maybe pieces of art, fountains, even things like the bridges aren't going to show up in tax assessor records as being historic. So we do have to walk the entire area and keep an eye out. And if there is something that catches our eye that's less than 50 years old, we definitely document it and take notes. If we thought it would meet the criteria for listing, we would definitely include it, even though it's outside of our survey methodology.
I'd also add that there's two checks on that. One is that there was a 45-day public comment period in the draft EIS. Commission commented on the draft EIS and the project. That is the big opportunity for people to flag resources that they feel like have been missed. And then in addition, there's SHPO. Every state has a SHPO, and ours has looked at the process. We've been consulting and engaging them since 2017 and letting them know our process. And we've received several letters to them saying they agree with the process, that these sound like the right things. We made adjustments to the APE, including extending the year of construction in order to make sure we capture things. And so that's part of their job as well.
Okay, and then I just have a quick comment about, I'm kind of excited about the idea of a survey of the South Portland Historic District, and I am serving on the advisory group as those design guidelines are being put together. So the timing of that update for that survey of that area could be pretty critical potentially to that effort. So has there been discussion with Bureau of Planning and Sustainability on that at all?
No, so you commit to it if you move forward with a project. So this would become what's included in our record of decision for the National Environmental Policy Act through the memorandum of agreement that we meet with SHPO and FTA. If the project moves forward, then we're committed to it. If the project doesn't move forward, then we aren't impacting any of the resources, and therefore there wouldn't be a need to mitigate and update the findings of the district.
And it sounds like even if it does go forward, it's going to be quite a few years probably before that gets done.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
I think I had one very brief question, and this is, I think, mostly for Andrea, but anyone on the property on the project team, really. But wondering if you put together formal avoidance alternatives for the properties determined to have an adverse effect, especially those that are, you know, have sort of a major effect, like, you know, being removed.
Well, I think that has Parametrics been dealing with that more for the Section 4F analysis?
Yeah, so if something becomes an adverse impact from a historic standpoint, it kicks it over to the aforementioned 4F, and that's where that avoidance. So if you remember that I showed a couple graphics that showed these angles and showed that all the other resources that could be impacted as a result of shifting the station, we collectively as a team have gone through those kind of, okay, what can we do to avoid this park, or what do we do to avoid trees? You know, so we've been doing a lot of that, and that has been documented. That would be, I think, in the Section 4F documentation.
Okay.
This is Commissioner Roman. I just had one quick question about how all this history can sort of set out some design principles for how the stations and all the sort of amenities might be designed in context. I mean, is there some opportunity for individualized kind of neighborhood feeling based on the history that you've done, or will the end result be sort of just the same station design at every place along the line? Is there sort of an analysis of how we can make the new work kind of play off the history of the place and what the, you know, it's a corridor, it's been a corridor. So it seems like there's a lot of opportunities, the roadside motels, you know, is there an opportunity to have some of that, you know, kind of enlighten, or I'm not sure the word I'm looking for, but sort of the design elements to sort of speak to those history elements.
Commissioner Roman, I think that's a great idea, and it's something that we do historically on our project, no pun intended, excuse me. If you look at our yellow line, you will see that we reflected the communities that we went through the artwork that was at our station. So if you go up to you go up to the expo facility, you can see tags of luggages that an artist had to reflect that Japanese were held there before they were moved out into Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon. So we've tried to use cultural resources to reflect the history of the community we're going through. You know better than the Tillicum Crossing and the artwork that got reflected there. On the Orange Line at Westmoreland Park Pond, we provided information that reflects that neighborhood and the ownership through that. So we do that with all of our projects. We try and understand those places that we're going through and try and reflect it in the design of the station or some elements that come from that. And I would think that this project would be no different than that.
And that comes after you've kind of gotten the go-ahead for the basic orientation of everything. You're not designing stations yet. You're basically getting kind of your
well, each of our stations have elements of consistency. They're all going to have a shelter. They're all going to have a place where you check your buy your ticket, do all of that element. Those have got to be standard, but there are places that we can play off of that, whether it's a windscreen or something else that reflects the community that we're going through.
Thank you.
Okay, any last questions, commissioners, or shall we start some quick discussion about mitigation strategies as proposed? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close the discussion then to everyone except commissioners. And I'd really appreciate just a quick thought or two from you about the mitigation that is proposed and any other pieces of this project that, you know, leap to your mind. Chris, did you need to say something? Okay, thanks. So I'll go ahead and start, and I do definitely appreciate the proposal that the viaducts and bridges be put on the hair. You know, that's a really intensive and very useful reference, and you know, I think that's definitely one step, you know, it's more than one step beyond the Oregon documentation standards, and I think they deserve that. I could see some of these properties potentially being listed as mitigation for other things happening along this route. So for instance, you showed us like that Rasmussen Village, you know, that's just visually, you know, that looks like a pretty interesting piece, but there could be other ones that potentially you go ahead and do the work to put something on the National Register rather than have it remain just sort of eligible. I'm definitely concerned about the congregation Ahavath Ahim. Forgive me if I've just butchered the pronunciation of that, but not having seen your full avoidance alternatives, I don't know whether you actually looked at doing some repurposing of that building. And I think for me, that would be in keeping with the ideals of this project, you know, really sort of trying to keep that as a building or as a structure in and of itself, rather than sort of going all the way to it's going to be removed, we're going to, you know, do a Habs documentation of it. So yes, there needs to be an interpretive display, etc., but I just having especially read all the letters that we did receive about that building, and knowing, you know, as a longtime resident of Portland myself, it's such visually distinctive building. and really does play a part in the culture of Portland. And I just think as part of the representative government of Portland that had such a big part to do with decimating South Portland and the urban renewal that went before us, you know, that sort of Jewish piece of history has primarily been erased. So I think we have a larger responsibility here. And so I would really I would really like to see the building be repurposed and now kept on site, perhaps secondarily moved if that's possible. The Jewish shelter home, I do think it's very worrisome to hear somebody, you know, who owns the property not having been consulted or heard about this project at all. Trying to avoid taking that back hospital piece down at all is obviously a primary concern, but I do think that those conversations really need to happen quickly. That's all I have for now. Other commissioners?
Commissioner Spears, I agree with Commissioner Miner saying, Chair Miner saying, same thing. I would love to see what the alternatives were to not impact a congregation synagogue. How to repurpose it? What options are there? Those are the things that I guess I'm not seeing. I'm more seeing of what is being moved towards, not so much what are all the things we looked at in between. And I would love to be able to take a look at those and see if there's a way we can maintain some of this without having to just demolish, which is something I think we try to steer away from a lot when it comes to our historic properties and culture situations. So just kind of echoing what Chair Miner already said, I agree with some of the same things. There's just pieces that I'm missing that I would love to, some steps that we weren't a part of and we're just getting this part now. So I would love to see all those other steps in place too and those other alternatives that were put in place.
Commissioner Fajmayor, I want to also support Commissioner Minor comments, and I am also want to show some concern about the two properties that have been shown to be demolished for Park and Ride. I feel like it's such a non-sustainable process to demolish two historic properties for Park and Ride. And if there might be some other options that we can look at and that we can hear or understand what were the process that went through it. And what is it that we're looking at if we're looking for this whole climate line to be a more sustainable city, why are we doing that as part of this sustainable process? So just some of the small details that I would like to have more understanding and how this is moving forward and where we can fit in and help to make it even better. I mean, I support the project. I support the alignment. We talked about it, but I want to hear more about all the things like Commissioner Spears said too. What are the decisions behind it and how we can help you guide and give you a better guidance on what's coming after.
This is Commissioner Foti. I'll be quick. I concur with my fellow commissioners on what's been said specifically about the temple and really pushing hard to keep it or find ways to integrate it. It's exciting. I would say Barber Boulevard is pretty deadly right now. It's not a pleasant place to be. So it's exciting this project's happening, exciting that we're bringing in light rail. We need that for future. We need to encourage and develop public transit, but it would be nice to do it in a way that keeps as much of the Portland character and levels of history as much as possible, because then it just becomes sort of another bland integration and or sort of a bland update to our city when we have an opportunity to make something really exciting and just a little bit more complex. As far as the mitigation strategies go, I also concur with Commissioner Miner. I mean, that would be exciting to update the National Register nomination. I guess a super quick question to you, Commissioner Miner, as far as updating a National Register nomination versus updating our local inventory or historic resources inventory? Just one, the priority for one, are we prioritizing one over the other? Is it just the safest to just do the National Register nomination updates whenever possible? That's all I had.
I mean, I know we did come out in support of making sure that all of that information got sucked into our, you know, our city database, and I still think that's very important. So I personally don't necessarily, you know, see one as coming, you know, on a higher priority than another. I think they're both okay. important, and the team could propose either one or both if, right. you know, thanks.
All right. That's it. Thank you.
This is Commissioner Roman. I'll echo what's been said so far, but just add the one thing about the synagogue. When I looked at some of the drawings and the letters, and it's sticking just ever so slightly in the way. It's not like the whole building, and it made me wonder whether an interesting remodel where you just clipped the building somehow and created a new entrance. It was orientated towards the rail line anyway, and then repurposed the building. I don't know. Would that be the end of the world? It's a tricky design problem in that it's a round building, but it doesn't have any windows or doors on that side, and so it's kind of like, well, could you just slice a piece off and add an entrance and then leave the building? I don't know what my fellow commissioners think about that, but it seemed a shame to tear the whole thing down when it was just slightly in the way. So that's all I have to add.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I'll concur with that as well. I think, I think the mitigation strategies that have been put on the table are substantive, and they would, you know, they would certainly provide mitigation and a benefit. So I applaud the project team for that. But, you know, the synagogue building is going to, it's a tough one to just get there that it's going to be gone without really understanding more about how the plan got to that point to begin with.
As Commissioner Mahoney, I agree with everything that's been said, and also appreciate the suggestion about keeping at least some of that synagogue building kind of as a remnant, as a way to help tell the story of, how they'd already been pushed out by urban renewal from South Auditorium, and now they're, you know, it's essentially getting pushed out again. And I think that could be a powerful story for how minorities have been treated in Portland. That's all.
Okay. I would, I think that's, you know, for now, I think that's some good feedback from us. Can we ask the project team perhaps to share your, you know, the alternatives that you did look at specifically on the synagogue? Is that something that could be shared with us just, you know, even offline? We're all definitely interested in looking for ways to maintain that at least as a building, as a structure in place.
Can I respond?
Sorry, I didn't make that very clear, did I?
I wasn't sure if I was allowed to, given what the conversation. So I think I hear what I heard what the commission said. There's concern about the, and we are too, recognize that we're not out about taking out historic buildings. You know, that's not the first blush that we look at. It's really about safety and looking at that. So we've done a lot of workshopping on this as a building, not as a building and its space and occupying space. There's a wall there that goes down to the basement. We haven't done as much about reuse, so that's fair. I think that's a fair criticism of us. You know, we worry about SEPTED principles and viewing things and how people walk between the incline elevator and hiding that. So there are some other issues that are associated with that. But I hear what you're looking for is give us a little bit more of a feel, and I gave you about five slides of that, of why we haven't come up with the result yet, but I think we can provide a synopsis of some of the workshops that we did on this. I think the reuse is something that we probably need to look at a little bit more, but fundamentally, I think we're also concerned about crime prevention through environmental design, being having those clean lines of sight to the inclined elevator, to the station and such, that having the building occupied there doesn't provide as much. And the queuing there is, all right, I'm going into my thing again. Yes, I think we can get you some additional information on the workshopping that we did. And I think we can probably get that to Hillary instead of coming back.
Yep. Okay. Dave, if the commission were to write a letter summarizing their comments today, when would you need that by?
I think you got 3 or 4 weeks. Chris, you're still here. What would you say? Today's the 22nd of June. Our thought is that we're publishing the environmental impact statement August, probably late September. So there's a little bit of time. So we also have engagement with some other parties that we talked about that are going to start happening from here out. So Chris, when do you think a letter would be apropos?
I think if we receive it by mid-July, there's no problem.
Okay.
And you can address it to TriMet, you can address it to TriMet Metro, FTA, SHPO. I wouldn't worry about it. It's clearly about this project.
Somebody want to maybe take up that task?
And it sounds like you've got some materials coming in, particularly about the synagogue and other things to consider. So again, go ahead and use that until mid-July timeframe. Mm-hmm. I think we've heard I've heard no surprises in terms of your discussion. So.
Yeah. Great. Okay. At this point, we are running a little behind schedule, so I'd like to propose just a 5-minute break before our next item, commissioners. So if we reconvene at, how about 3:32, sounds crazy, then it will give the next presenter a little time to set up, and we can all stand up and take a break. So I'm going to mute myself and turn off my camera and see you all in 5 minutes. Thanks for your presentation.
Thank you for your time and volunteering for this great endeavor. Do appreciate it. Thank you.